Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3055. Is that right? You got that right? Yes. Representative Nolan, will you join us and whoever you want with your escorts? You're here to make sure Representative Nolan stays in line, is
okay.
That right?
That is too big a responsibility to give anyone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Nolan. I have the privilege of representing Southwest Portland in the House, and I appreciate your hearing House Bill 3055. I have asked Carol Studenman, who was, along with her son and daughter, the inspiration for this bill, and wanted her to have a chance to explain to you what we're trying to accomplish. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my interest in bringing this forward is to help assure that we have an adequate available inventory of anatomical organs for donation in times of emergency. And in particular, we are interested in increasing the inventory, the availability of cadaver donors in order to help reduce the need for living donor anatomical gifts. And Ms. Studenman can give you a little bit of the background on why this has come to my attention and why I hope you will join me in supporting this legislation.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carol Studenman, and I live in Southwest Portland. And my family has been affected by a tragedy involving a living donation. My husband donated his kidney to his nephew 5 years ago, and unfortunately the doctors didn't give him the care he should have had, and he died as a direct result of that. At the time that he was getting ready to do this donation, he was told that the chances of anything going wrong were like, oh gosh, one in a billion. And after his death, we found out it was more like one in 1,700 living donors die as a result of organ donation. And the reason for that story being told to my husband is because there's just so much pressure on people to help someone who's on the waiting list for an organ donation. About a third of the people who are on the waiting list die while they wait for an organ to become available to them. And that can be pretty unbearable for families and friends to witness and to watch go on. So there's a lot of pressure these days in society on people to go ahead, and why don't you just step up and make it happen? And I'm here to say that that's not always, you know, the first thing you should think about. So the whole system of organ donation is very complicated, and there are a lot of people involved. And when we all make the choice to either sign the organ registry to be donors or to put the D on our driver's license or to do both, sometimes that wish is not honored. And we'd like to make sure that that wish is honored so that anyone who has made that choice, that wish can be honored should they pass away and be available to be a donor, so that the whole system can work well and more people don't go through what our family's gone through.
Thank you. Are there questions? And the reason this bill came about is because there's a sense that in the difficult time around somebody dying, that decisions are made that countermand the decisions of the people who has just died.
Right.
The person who's just died.
Exactly, Chair Greenlick. The families, sometimes, you know, their grief can be overwhelming, and I know that feeling. And this kind of framing of the situation allows the folks involved with organ donation to frame their conversation with the families as that we're here to follow your loved one's wishes. And it makes a big difference. It sounds really subtle, but it makes a big difference in having the system work well.
Mr. Chair, do we have other testifiers?
No.
Yes.
Oh, do we? Huh, okay.
You will hear from people representing the Oregon banks and their perspective on the bill, and I don't want to preempt them and speak for them.
We'll get the list.
But you will.
Look at
yes,
it.
You do have a few other people to testify.
Excellent. No, not a question. We dealt with the anatomical donor issue in 2007 and had extensive testimony, and I was actually very impressed by that whole dialogue. And the driver's license came up. It came up more than a couple times in conversation about, well, the driver's license is kind of just a guide. It doesn't really mean anything. And so I'm interested in to hear the testimony and how that goes.
Good.
This is interesting.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Maurer, in 2007, we brought a different approach to this issue and proposed a different solution. After having understood more and worked a bit more closely with representatives of the Oregon banks and the people who do this kind of work for a living, we share a common interest with them, and that is why you have a bill that approaches this from a slightly different angle, but makes it very clear that the donor's intent is to be honored, absent an affirmative change by that donor, or in the case of a minor, by the parents of that minor.
Well, thank you both very much. Thank you for bringing.
Thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
Very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Mike Seeley, Mary Jane Hunt, and Barbara Thompson, all of whom signed up in favor of the bill. So. Brief but heartfelt testimony is always welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for both of us to come before you. We have submitted written testimony, which I'm not going to read. We collectively, the Community Tissue Services, the Donate Life Northwest organization, the Alliance Eye Bank, and the organization I represent, I'm Mike Seeley, the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, and this is Mary Jane Hunt from Donate Life Northwest. We strongly support this bill, 3055. In essence, what it does is galvanize the decision of the individual, which, Vice Chair Maurer, you were correct in that last session we did a lot with the Anatomical Gift Act to strengthen donor rights and the intention of the donor not being intention as much as this is what I want to have happen. And the motor vehicle license, driver's license D, is confirmed as consent. And it has been historically, but the last revision of the Anatomical Gift Act shored that up. This is an additional step that we strongly support because the donor's right to donate does not get revoked by anyone. There are processes in the law to allow for a revocation if the individual wants to do that prior to death. And we believe this will enhance donation and will mitigate some of the conflicts. It does not change what we do with families as far as providing information, but it's a matter of disclosing to the family. Where there is no indication that they're a donor by registry or driver's license, we still get consent. So this is very positive.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Mary Jane Hunt, Executive Director with Donate Life Northwest. And in respect of time, I will just add that we have been very successful in the last couple of years since we were before you. The donor registry today has over 2 million Oregonians registered as donors. What this bill will do is it will strengthen their rights, and that it is very clear that their rights cannot be revoked.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Yes, sir. I guess I have an interesting question. I was quite surprised. My mother passed away a year ago, and we were at a hospital, and she had filed all the appropriate papers about her decisions. And towards the end, there was a conference called. And there was a nurse, an oncologist, a social worker, several other people. And my family was put through an interesting ordeal where we where we approached the issue once more. And I guess I'm wondering, is that something that happens here? Are families reconsulted? Is that why you want to do this? And how does that play out in similar fashion? I was rather taken back because I helped create some of the durable power of attorney and some of the other forms that we created back in the 90s. And I got to say, you know, under that emotional stress, to have to reconfront that, there's a piece of that that I think is entirely justified. I mean, we do not want to proceed, and sometimes people have changes of heart or mind. But boy, at that emotional time, that's a very difficult time for a family, particularly as there's often division of opinion among family members. To revisit it is pretty reprehensible, if I may use such strong language, from my perspective.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kennemer, there are a number of mechanisms in place, actually, beyond the specifics of a donor card, in that the hospitals are actually required by the conditions of participation for Medicare to refer every death for the potential of donation, and those circumstances that might lead to organ donation are much more remote, and that would be imminent death, so that a vetting of that opportunity is considered. If there is a condition that would be a contraindication to donation, we would know that ahead of time, and there wouldn't be a need for a conferencing. If donation and the circumstance, and I don't know the particulars, if tissue donation or eye donation was a possibility, even with the donor card in place, I mean, we have done a lot of work in the last 2 years getting hospitals to follow this procedure, to sensitively disclose that we have communication plans with the hospital staff as to how to approach family if there isn't an indication, and if there is, disclosing what will happen. And there is also a need to gather a medical social history, which could be part of that conferencing. There has to be that discussion in order to be good stewards of the if there's a possibility for donation and an organ or a tissue can be donated, we need to know as much about that individual's history. So I suspect it might be related to that. But
actually, this wasn't with regard, and I guess I failed to clarify, it wasn't with regard to donation because she was quite elderly and had a number of infirmities that made it unrealistic to be a donor. But just to revisit all of these issues at an emotional time puts a lot of family members and, frankly, the individual in a very difficult situation. And I just wondered if similar pressure might occur on potential donors.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kennemer, I think we put a lot of focus on trying to have good communication plans in the hospital. So
the assumption would be if there was a clear understanding of the wishes of the donor, this kind of conference would not need to happen.
Right.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
No. Mr. Chair, yeah. I mean, we all have licenses, and on the front, it says a restriction. If you're an anatomical donor, it says D. And on the back, it says it in two places. At least I have a license a couple of years old. But it's in two places. So the
prove your resident, your citizenship.
No, it doesn't. not this one.
Don't go there, please.
This wasn't. I registered a couple months before that went into effect. But the point is that we've got it on two places, and the intent is pretty clear. At least I hope it's clear when they check the box.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, actually what's great is the DMV and their support. We have that tied into our registry electronically, so our staff at any moment, 24/7, 365 days a year, can access that information, and that's your consent to donation. So that's tremendous. That's been the big step forward in the last 2 years.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Is Barbara Thompson here?
Yes, but I am.
You're all set. Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3055 and open a work session on House Bill 3055. Just give it to that man right sitting right there.
No, I want to.
Wait a minute. You want? Go ahead. Right away.
Mr. Please. Chair, I move House Bill 3055 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Harker has moved House Bill 3055 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to belabor the point, but this also fits into kind of neatly with our pulse, the physicians order life-sustaining treatment, and I think there's a kind of a neat little tie, and this is a something we all should support.
This is one more way to make sure that people's wishes are
absolutely
are honored, and I think that's
key.
I think that's very important. Would you take the roll, please?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Protek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Perhaps we could ask Representative Nolan if she'd like to carry it on the floor. Well, this is pretty straightforward.
Just do it.
Do it? Okay. We'll ask Representative Nolan to carry it. We will close the work sessions on HB 3055 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3041. You join us, Representative Norman?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
You can bring who you want. Do we have a sign-up sheet on this?
I think you should.
See if we can find one. And, Roxy, where did you go? Will you tell us what we're doing here? Well, I don't know if you can tell us what we're doing here, but maybe you can tell us what this bill does. That's too much to ask.
Mr. Chair, a public hearing was held on this bill on January 30th, and the bill changes the name of the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home and...
No.
Oh, 3041. Excuse me. Creates a pilot project of no more than 6 Head Start providers in the state to implement health literacy programs. The goal is to educate parents of Health Start children about common childhood ailments with the goal of improving children's health and reducing the number of children brought to emergency rooms for common illnesses such as cold or chickenpox. You have a fiscal that you received electronically. You also have a hard copy in front of you. There is no revenue impact.
Well, that's not entirely true. The fiscal says the bill must be go to Ways and Means and describes the revenue impact. I mean, the fiscal impact. So we will be having a subsequent on this one. Hopefully we'll move it out today and get it to Ways and Means so they can get to work on it. Please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I am Suzanne Van Orman. I am state representative of House District 52 for Hood River County, East Clackamas, and East Multnomah counties. I'm here today with former members of my staff to talk to you about a health care institute that we conducted in 2005. And it was, we had received a grant from UCLA, which was funded by Johnson & Johnson, and the vision was to enable poor and disadvantaged parents to be more informed and knowledgeable in order to effectively meet the health care needs of their children. The objectives were to enable parents to become better caregivers to their children by improving their health care knowledge and skills, to empower parents in their decision-making for the health care needs of their children, and to enhance the self-esteem and confidence of the parents in meeting their parental objectives, and to reduce health care costs by reducing unnecessary hospital, doctor, and clinic visits. I have submitted to you this packet, which has my letterhead on the front. And then the second page is the results of the research conducted by UCLA to demonstrate to you how effective the system was in reducing doctor visits and ER visits. And then the next page shows you how we impacted school and work days missed, and then our treatment locations. And then the last was a graph that shows you the drop. We had doctor visits dropped 42%, and ERs dropped 58%. And then on the back, being a former Head Start director, I always told my staff I was cost effective, and they let me know I was just cheap. So you have in front of you.
That's not the same thing. That's
yeah, I know. True. And you have in front of you a very modest budget based on 600 families, 100 families for the six for each Head Start, or an option two of 900 families, or an option three of 1,200. And UCLA has a licensing fee of $10 per family. The parent training, which is an extremely vital part of this, is $30, which included the book, and I think the book is being passed around for you so you can see it. And the book is What to Do When My Child Gets Sick. And then we had incentives and prizes to encourage people to come and enjoy the training. And then if we use the UCLA research to ensure that we are following up on it, it adds about $72 per family. So I will pass down the row to my former staff, who will introduce you themselves to you and tell you what their role was in this project to give you an idea of what we did.
Can you tell us what your former staff at what was?
Oh, excuse me, yes.
I assume it wasn't from the last session of legislation.
No, it was not, Representative Greenland. It certainly wasn't. I was the Head Start director in the Mid-Columbia Head Start program, and these people with me today are current staff of that Head Start program, and they will introduce themselves and tell you what their role was in this project.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Chair Greenlick and committee members, I'm Rhonda Hull, and I'm an area manager down in the Dalles Head Start. And the training session was designed to introduce parents the book What to Do When Your Child Gets Sick. It helped the parents understand types of information contained in the book, information related to illness and injury in the book, and how to use the book as a valuable resource. As the trainer's role, it was really important for parents to have a positive and valuable learning experience. It empowered parents for greater confidence on how to prevent illness and injury. Children missed fewer school days, and when children miss fewer school days, they're able to be there and learn. Parents missed fewer days at work and were able to have the confidence to deal with their illness and minor health concerns at home. The children achieve higher educational outcomes because when they're in school, they're healthier and are learning. The community will save resources and will benefit from healthier citizens who are eager to assist in their own health care. And the health community will see noticeable behavior changes from parents and families who have participated in the training, and will see families actively participate in their child's health. The best part about the training, I'll say, is it was individualized and we customized it for our families. It was culturally sensitive and allowed for inclusion strategies, and it was fun, the activities, and it was engaging for the learning process for all families.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Guillermina Cruz, and at that time I was a parent, and I had the opportunity to be in a training for the UCLA training, and when I received the book, it was very helpful for me, so because, and the most important thing is because I don't have insurance for my kids, so that will help me a lot before I take my kids to the doctor to look through the book, and it's very easy to see what you need, very helpful. And I love the book. And another thing is when I have the home visits from my teachers, they always ask me if I use it. And if I have any question, they show me through the book, you know, what I'm looking for. And I think it's a very good resource for the families.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I was the... My name is Karen Mooney, and I work with Mid-Columbia Children's Council. I'm the Family Services Manager. And at the time of the training, I was the person that was tracking the sheets of data that were coming through. We served, we were able to train approximately 106 families. Of those, 96% completed it. part of what the data tracking included was we did a pre-survey to see what kind of ways that families dealt with services. And actually, I think we passed around a copy of that pre-survey and post-survey. And we did the training, and then we did three follow-ups, one on each subsequent month, so that we asked them what had happened during the month, whether or not they'd used the book. We got the book out on home visits and reintroduced it to folks so that they would have an opportunity to reengage with the material. And then at the end of 6 months, we did a post-survey, and that's where the numbers you're seeing from the graph about Mid-Columbia Children's Council are coming from. I found that the training was a lot of fun, that it was well received by staff and by parents. It was kind of exciting for everyone. Everyone got a kit with a book and some items that were health related, like thermometers, you know, getting rid of the mercury thermometers and getting into the digital ones that was more healthy for their children. Other items of that nature. You noticed from the, I think that Suzanne covered that, but it went from a use of the health book from 3% to 52% of the parents were accessing that health book after the training. And usage of the doctor went down from 64% when a child was sick down to 27% and using the book instead. And the emergency room visits went from 0.9% of the people going there when their child was sick to 0%. So we had some good success. It was pretty exciting. In fact, I was so excited about that since I was kind of a new grandparent at the time that I made sure that my daughter had a copy of this book. And every time she calls me and said, "Oh, no, what's wrong? What should I do?" I said, "Did you read the book?" And she has, and it's been very successful. It's a lovely book. It's easy to read, easy for folks to access, and it has really clear information on what to do when you can handle it at home, when you should be calling your doctor, and when you need to get in a hurry, get to some sort of emergency assistance. Yeah. Thank you.
Are there questions to this panel?
Is there anybody else?
Oh, wait.
No.
Yeah, there are other.
I guess my question is, is this program, because I've been aware of it for a couple years, has this program been utilized by any of the fully capitated plans that you know of, or any other programs in the state besides the venues that you're looking for?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, I am not aware of any. This particular program was focused with Head Start because of the relationship that we've had with UCLA and Johnson & Johnson since 1991. And I do know, though, that in my conversation with CARE Oregon, they're very interested in it. And one of the challenges, I thought, when a representative from Johnson & Johnson came to me and said, "What can we do in Oregon?" is having access to the group. And Head Start, for me, was the logical choice because we have these children enrolled and we have parents, and the Head Start program does the home visiting and the classroom. And it just seemed a logical thing for Head Start to do that. So I can't speak for other groups, but it's a very simple program. It really is not an expensive program, but unfortunately for Head Start, the cost of the book is, surprisingly. So to answer your question, I am not familiar with other programs doing this.
Can I, Ms. Mooney, I think you're probably the one who was talking about the tables, and you'll have to suffer with me as a researcher in this case rather than as a representative.
Okay.
I can't help noting the fact that school days missed went up.
That is true of our program.
Is that a good thing? Or, I mean, does that keep kids home when they're sick? Is that the value of that? Or?
I am aware that that is part of the results of that. And keep in mind that the typical time periods when children are sick the most are during the winter. And unfortunately, we did the pre-information study when they were... It's not during the high sick times, and we did the post time when it was during the high sick times. But even though they were sick and maybe kept home, they were still at least weren't taken to the emergency room or taken to their doctor when it was possible to care for them at home.
But you have to note that the work days decreased.
And the parents.
Yes.
The missed work days.
Missed work days.
Yeah.
So that was...
I
That is a positive.
We get a discussion. I did an evaluation of the HealthWise book, which is a book published in Boise, and the publishers gave out 280,000 copies of the book throughout the Boise, Idaho area, and we did an evaluation of it to look at the community differences in the use of emergency room and other things. And we actually found with a one-year lag time, we found a significant reduction in emergency room use simply having that book throughout a whole community. It was very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Nancy Perrin and Morgan Allen. Gee, Morgan, I miss you this year since I haven't been on the in the Education Committee. Three of my colleagues have probably seen more of you than they want.
No, following us everywhere we go.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Erica Hagedorn. Nancy Perrin, who's the president of the Oregon Head Start Association, was coming over the pass today, and it looks like she got caught up. They were at a meeting over in Redmond for the Head Start Association. So we wanted to register our very brief but enthusiastic support for House Bill 3041. We feel like this will be good for kids and good for parents. Kids can go to school more. Parents can go to work more. Parents will have to pay less for costly ER physicians visits that might be unnecessary. And it'll also arm parents with the ability to detect serious children's illnesses in a fast manner. So we appreciate your time and support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's good to see you. For your record, I'm Morgan Allen. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here today. I heard you mention that you're hoping to work session this today, and I hope we can delay that just a little bit because I've been working with Representative Van Orman and her staff this week, and I think I've come up with an amendment that Representative Van Orman supports that will allow this to get down to Ways and Means and will actually allow it to happen and not get stuck down there and die. So.
Excellent. Well, I was hoping it would happen even, I mean, there's a relatively modest fiscal even.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. There is a relatively modest fiscal to this, but as you know, the department and all agencies are in a tough spot this year, and even the smallest additions to work that in a normal circumstance you wouldn't be hearing from me, and we would say we're happy to work through that or try to absorb that. We're keeping careful track of those. So the amendments I've handed out right now I think will help it get through Ways and Means for a couple of reasons. The first is the way the bill is currently constructed, there are a lot of shalls in the bill, and the bill directs the department to go out and seek grant funds, so we do some grant writing and fundraising to attempt to fund this program. If we were unsuccessful in that attempt, then it would be in law that we would have to fund some pilot programs, so we'd have to take that out of our general fund from some other program. So I think the first thing we'd like to do is just change some of those shalls to mays in case we're unable to secure any grant funding or private funding.
Representative Van Orman, will you join us?
Sure.
Go ahead, Morgan. Thank you. Let me keep going.
And then the second thing that we would like to do, and this, it won't change the fiscal, Mr. Chair, but it would change it from a general fund to an other fund fiscal. I talked to a representative about this, is that if we are able to secure some private funding or grant money, that we could use a small portion of that to help cover some of the administrative costs to do that. And I've committed to the representative that we would, depending on how much we got and how many programs are funded, I definitely think we could keep that below $20,000 for the biennium. And then the last thing that I think will keep the fiscal down is in the bill created a mandatory legislative report, and I've spoken to the representative about that. I think if we take that language out and commit to coming to this committee and the education committees and reporting on a more informal basis on the progress of the programs, it would help with the fiscal and help us get it through Ways and Means. So, Mr. Chair, with that, again, I'm working with the representative staff, and hopefully we can have an amendment for you early next week that move it down to Ways and Means. And I think if we made these changes that we could get it through Ways and Means and get it out, because this is really one of those no-brainer programs, as you heard from the providers.
Is that okay with you, Representative?
That's a good thing.
Yes, we talked about it, and I think for me, I'm not going to quibble over shall and may. I felt that it would be up to the committee. If the committee feels that we strongly that we ought to do that, then I think that's up to the committee. But I really want to see us do this, and if that's one of the sticking points. I'm definitely willing to give up on that. I also think that there's enough evidence collected by UCLA that demonstrates that this does work, and that a report is probably not necessary. And then what was the other one? We had a third one? Oh, the administrative costs. He's promised me that it will be modest, and I'm glad to see that they came down from their immodest assumption, so I can live with that. But we do think that there is money out there, like Johnson & Johnson, maybe the Northwest Health Foundation, that we might be able to at least get 100 kids in six programs, so 600 kids.
The ones who benefit, besides the kids and the families, are the health plans,
yes,
and the hospitals.
That's true.
Fully capitated plans. They're the ones that are going to benefit financially by keeping children out of the ERs. So I would have a hard time believing that they would be encouraged by some of these results and more than willing to participate,
yeah,
financially.
I was even encouraged by the keeping kids home from school, because I think, that is a serious statement. I think if parents recognize when it's appropriate for a child to be at school, when not, and they get some help from this book, that would be a very useful enterprise. And if May doesn't work, then we'll make it shall in the next session.
Representative Glean, if I could just say, one of the factors that we, and members of the committee, one of the factors we neglected to mention is that we did fundraise in our local communities, and our hospitals contributed.
Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, I enthusiastically support this, and I would hope that we would establish some kind of a working relationship where the committee can continue these discussions. I think this is foundational for what we're trying to do in healthcare reform. One of the big problems we have is appropriate access and appropriate use of healthcare services. It's a big cost driver, and I think this meshes well with the Asheville Project and some other national studies that have established clearly that if people know more about how to deal with healthcare, the costs go down. And we can talk reform all we want to, but if we don't put these kind of things on the ground, we're not going to get a change in behavior that gets us truly healthcare reform. So I would like to see this be an ongoing thing, and I don't want to take it away from Head Start, but maybe we could even talk sometime about expanding it into a more general kind of program.
We're beginning to create an interim agenda.
Yeah.
Because once we close as a committee in our ability to move bills, at least last time, we got permission to stay in session beginning our interim work while we were all here. And I think this question of health literacy, self-help, would be a really important interim topic, and we're gathering that list. And as soon as our administrator gets done with the task I just gave her, which is to try and find out when would be the best day to reschedule this, you haven't talked to Ledge Council yet, have you?
Mr. Chair, we actually just came up with these amendments in the last 24 hours in an attempt to make sure that it gets out of Ways and Means. So,
and I appreciate that. Tentatively, I think we'll carry it over till next Friday, but I want to get a look at Monday, Wednesday. Perhaps Ms. Queller also Friday's agenda as well. Let's get a look at them, and we can get specific about it. Unless there are other questions, yes.
Just a comment following on Representative Thompson's. It was interesting. The book, I think, retails for $12.95. Mm. That's less than one doctor visit.
It's way less.
Way less. But I mean, it's pretty interesting. One of the things that I've been struggling with 2009 is where do we go for the good ideas to cut costs? And here's one that's already been demonstrated.
Yeah, it's been demonstrated in more than one circumstance.
More than one state.
We probably also could reduce that if we went to the Dr. Greenlick Oregon book yet to be written. And he reduced his profit margin on his work. We could get this down.
I mean, actually, one of the issues of, say, the HealthWise, which has a children's and a senior's book as well, is there are ways to find donations of these books for use. But the important thing isn't only a book, and I think that's what that's what your project showed. There are two pieces. There's the training and the getting people to use, and the other thing that was useful when you're using it in a community is what's really important is what was testified there. When somebody calls a doctor to ask about something, and the nurse can say, you have this, what to do when your child gets sick. Look at page 12, and let's go over that. I mean, it's building the availability of these things into the medical and the culture. How are we doing on agenda?
Representative Greenlick, if I may add one more thing. The other important part is the follow-up with the families. That's very important.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Morgan, I don't mean to be argumentative. Just curious. If we kept it shall in the first section, section 1-1, but changed everything else to may, would it still have the same fiscal? By shall, we're setting up at least the framework in the department, but really all the mays respond to the that it has to be funded. And because I think I'm just wondering if that would have...
Mr. Chair and Representative Kotek, I think you're probably right. I think I would agree with that assessment. If we change that first may back to a shall, we would not necessarily have to select a program to do that, but our preference would be a may, just so that that's very clear that the legislative intent is that if there's funding available and that we're able to secure private funds or donations, that we go ahead and do this, and that there would be no question that if there was no money available or we were unsuccessful in getting any grants, that we would not have to select a provider and do that. I think you could get into some questions about the law says you shall establish a pilot program. There's no funds to do it. You know, it would just be cleaner in our opinion, Representative.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if there being no further questions, I will close the work session on HB 3041 and hold it over for a work session on Friday. I think it will take that long to get you the amendments. If you don't have them by Friday, we'll need both the amendments and a new fiscal. So,
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, the fiscal will probably not change. It's just a question of where the money would come from. The current way
but if it makes it clear it's on other funds rather than the general fund,
that's correct.
That would change, and
yes,
that's an important change.
That's actually a good point.
Yeah, I mean, and if you can get it changed enough so it doesn't even have to go to Ways and Means, that would be even better. So you may work with the fiscal at the fiscal office at the same time you're working with LC, and let us know how that goes. But if not, we'll do it. And if Friday's too soon, then we'll get it.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you very much for bringing it to us. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2243, which also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means for an odd reason. And Ms. Quiller, would you tell us about what 2243 does?
Yes, there is a public hearing on this previously, and it changes the name of the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators to the Nursing Home Administrators Board. It establishes the Oregon Health Licensing Agency as the authority to provide administrative and regulatory oversight for the Nursing Home Administrators Board. There are -2 amendments that were requested by the Governor's Office. You have a fiscal statement. There is no revenue impact, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
There's a fiscal on 2243.
Yes.
Lots of stuff. Oh, you have a hand and gross version, I think, also on 2243. And we have a work session. We have some folks here if there are any questions, but the it got a fiscal, not because it's going to add anything new, I believe, in revenues or in fiscals, but because it moves the budget to a different agency. So Ways and Means wants to make sure the agency issues get taken care of. But it is very straightforward. Can somebody tell us what the dash twos do? Do we have an update from the governors? We have the health licensing agency acting administrator with us today. It would be. Let's hear what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeForest, acting director for the health licensing agency. Essentially, the dash two amendments will provide an emergency clause effective July 1st, 2009. That gives us a very clear biennial break, allows us to close the books on the current biennium within the Nursing Home Administrators Board and reopen the books again for health licensing agency. That's really the fundamental cause for the amendments.
But it does some other things, right?
Get my glasses out real quick. As I get older and as I move through, I think this is my ninth session.
Page two. Actually, the second page, two, the one after a blank page, two, it has a deletion. Is that, it looks like in the Hand and Gross on line 19 to 20. And this, I think, allows the governor, allows that the members all serve at the
pleasure,
at the pleasure of the governor, which is what we've tried to do in other things.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Also changed the term limits. I mean, it has a term in term limits, I think. Is that right now?
The term limits within the bill itself.
Oh, not in the... Okay. Okay. Got a lot of blank pages. Okay. Are there any questions? It would be my intention to move this on to Ways and Means. It's something that the governor is working on already. And... I think you favor it in your agency, is that right?
Mr. Chair, we have support of the board itself, of the association that works with the nursing home administrators, and the support of the governor's office and the health licensing agency.
Right. May I have a motion on this?
You may, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated March 27, 2009.
Representative Harker moves that we adopt the dash two amendments dated 3/27/09. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Another motion, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I move HB 2243 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Devereaux?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Penimer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries. 2243 is on its way to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Somebody didn't get to vote on the first bill.
I came in late, Mr. Chair.
And did you get to vote on the first one?
I did.
Okay.
But Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion that we reopen House Bill.
We suspend the rules and
suspend the rules. 3055 to allow Representative Garrett to cast a vote.
Is there any objection? Your vote?
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Is that one I vote on?
I think you only missed the anatomical.
I was giving him a bad time. I said, is that one I vote now?
I can attest that he was down at a different committee.
I'm sure that's true. We're all pretty busy nowadays. Let me give you a progress report on 2728 that's carried over from the 4-1 agenda without opening the work session. The governor's office is working on an amendment to 2009 that makes that Children's Connect program more specific and is an amendment being prepared for 2009. We've been able to get that 19-page bill we heard that would do that down to about a 4-page amendment, which includes the substance. Is that right, Representative Kotek? Have you been involved in that discussion?
Mr. Chair, I did have a conversation with the governor's staff about including it. I have not seen the language.
I haven't seen the language either, but they've assured me it is in, and we had asked for it today. I've granted them freedom, and they will have it for us on Monday, which should have the language of that and a couple of other things. Any nods out there? Is that your understanding? Yep, I think so. Okay, so we won't have to open that. Let's open a first public hearing on House Bill 3243. Ms. Queller, will you tell us what it is? And Representative Dembro, will you be prepared to orchestrate at least to testify?
The bill itself prohibits discrimination by any medical personnel that are licensed under ORS Chapter 677. Prevents discrimination against any patient, either current or former, who is Medicare eligible or would be eligible within 1 year. And there is an amendment to this bill, a Dash 1 amendment. The effect of the Dash 1 amendment is to limit the bill to providing sanctions by the Oregon Medical Board in the event that a medical personnel license under Chapter 677 should terminate a relationship with a patient solely because they are Medicare eligible or would become eligible within 1 year. We have received a fiscal and revenue impact, and there is neither a fiscal nor a revenue impact from this bill. Excuse me, we don't have those. This is a public hearing only.
Yep.
So we have a revenue, but not a fiscal.
Dembro, you're a recently added co-sponsor of this bill, is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Michael Dembro, representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose, and I present this bill 3243 to you. Colleagues, we have talked repeatedly over the course of this session about the problem of inadequate reimbursement rates for Medicaid and Medicare providers. And we've seen this problem most dramatically in the area, the frontline areas of primary care. I don't need to tell you that we on the committee have been stressing our brains about ways of enhancing incentives for people who go into primary care, either through improving Medicaid reimbursement rates through the hospital assessment reform, and also various incentives for primary care providers in the rural areas or otherwise. You may or may not know that a memorial is being drafted right now, a memorial to Congress to support efforts to increase the Medicare reimbursement rates for Oregon, removing or at least reducing the penalties that Oregon receives for being successful in many ways, for being efficient and able to deliver care at a lower cost. I think we all understand the challenges that...
Excuse me, Representative Dembro.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I've been delinquent in saying House Bill 2009 is shown on the agenda, but we do not intend to open that up today. So if there's anybody waiting in the audience for... I think that's true, is that?
Actually, Mr. Chair, we do have someone who... who wants to speak briefly about a workforce issue.
Okay, great.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Then
thank
we
you.
Will be opening up.
Great.
I'm sorry.
Yes,
thank you.
We all understand the huge challenges, I think, that providers face with the current reimbursement rates. And it's causing people all over the delivery system to make adjustments and compromises that I know they'd rather not make. Providers feel that they cannot take on new patients who would receive their funding through Medicare, which essentially forces those patients onto other providers who are themselves stressed. I think we all understand how difficult this is for healthcare professionalism in general. But I've recently learned about a practice that I think really crosses the line into what I would consider to be an unprofessional response to the problem, as significant as the problem is. Some physicians are dropping patients with whom they have had a long-standing relationship once they reach Medicare age. The patients are being dropped simply because they are now eligible for Medicare. And I think we passed out to you some testimony from a gentleman who found himself in that situation. He had a 10-year plus relationship with a physician and was notified once he reached Medicare age that he was being dropped. He's a gentleman with diabetes. He was given this information on short notice. It really made things very difficult for him. And as I understand it, during the Health Fund Board hearings, there was, a number of people came forward and also spoke to having had this experience, which is obviously really problematic. It leaves patients in a very difficult position. Although, I know that this is not the intention of the providers, but it really takes, it turns out to be another form of age discrimination, really. People being dropped because they have reached that age that they qualify for Medicare. And so that's the reason that House Bill 3243 has been submitted. What the bill does is it adds to the list of causes for medical board sanction the dropping of patients solely because of their eligibility for Medicare. You'll notice that the bill has been amended as it was originally submitted. There was a drafting error or as I understand it, it was a drafting error. Anyway, the first two parts, which brought the sanctions under the same statute that has to do with, I think, housing and whatever.
With age discrimination.
Age discrimination in general. Those have been dropped, and it just applies to it's being handled by the medical board, which is the appropriate place for it. So, again, colleagues, this is not intended as a punitive measure against doctors. Certainly on a Friday afternoon, I would not want to do that. And to be honest, I would not consider supporting this position if I didn't feel that we were also simultaneously working in a positive and proactive way to improve the ability of physicians to treat Medicare patients and to maintain long-standing supportive relationships with them through the other things that we're talking about. But at the same time, we need to say that in the meantime, we disapprove of physicians who cut their patients loose to fend for themselves in a very difficult, insecure arena, which is what the healthcare arena is today. So there are a few people who are going to testify about their experience or their knowledge of this issue, and I'll turn it over to them. Before doing that, I'd like to thank my legislative assistant, Logan Gillis, for his work in coordinating this testimony and helping us do this on very short notice. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, and it may be more of a question that came to me about the original bill. When I first heard talk about the problem of physicians not seeing Medicare patients, yet with Medicare being a federal program and physicians not being required under federal rules to see Medicare patients, I'm just wondering, is there a conflict legally between what we're trying to accomplish here and the federal laws, or it's really not a fair question of you, but do you know if that's been considered, whether we actually can legally do this in light of federal law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, I don't know the you know, the legal issues, you know, affecting this. But it seems to me that, you know, there are a number of issues that the medical board looks at when they are judging the professionalism of physicians, and those are under our purview. And it seems to me that, you know, this practice, I don't see a reason that it wouldn't be.
This bill doesn't require physicians to see Medicaid patients. There are lots of physicians who refuse to see Medicaid patients. This is a bill about patient abandonment, as I understand it. It's about the question of when it's appropriate for a professional to abandon a patient of longstanding and not. I think that's the issue. And I think this sort of would break new grounds on this. But, for example, if a physician abandoned a patient in the middle of a treatment regime, there was no other alternative, I think that would be very clearly viewed as. And in an environment where there are so many physicians that won't take Medicare, I mean, this is really becomes a significant question, I think. At least it seems reasonable for us to consider it. And I think I think they've improved the bill by taking it out of the, out of the age discrimination.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'll wait for the other
people. Senator Maurer, did you have?
Well, I just, I have a lot of problem with the bill. I mean, I'm not quite sure how you forced someone to provide a service at a loss. And, I mean, it doesn't say, so instead of handing the letter at age 65, they hand the letter at age 63 and 355 days, 64 days, and they skirt the law. I think it gets...
Physicians wouldn't skirt the law.
Well, I mean, if it was about, you know, they have a number of patients and they're on the edge of keeping the door open or not, then maybe this does make that decision easier for them. It's just unfortunate that physicians get paid less and it costs them to provide the service, and people look at them and say, you're obligated to see this person anyway. I mean, they have a moral obligation from a societal standpoint, but we don't have to create a government structure to force that to happen. And
it is certainly historical for physicians to treat patients on a sliding scale, where they're reimbursed less on some patients and more on others is a
and now we have
part of the great
mandate called Medicare and Medicaid that kind of eliminates the sliding scale.
Well, but it doesn't eliminate it, it creates a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. I mean, it creates two tiers. If you can only charge what Medicare pays, then this wouldn't be a problem. So some people obviously charge more than Medicare can be paid, because if they weren't, then they wouldn't abandon them, because that's what they would get whether they were in Medicaid or not.
There wouldn't be very many doctors out there seeing any patients because they couldn't pay their light bill and they couldn't pay their staff. And
yeah. Again, Mr. Chair, I think this is a particular problem for primary care providers, just the way the system is set up. But I'm happy to turn it over to other people to share their experience.
Representative Thompson.
I understand the problem, and I'm certainly sympathetic, but I kind of share the concerns, too, because I happen to be one of the people who got a letter from my doctor telling me that since I had been with him for 10 years, he was going to continue me into my, you know, doddering years.
Your dotage, yes.
Yeah, but not accept any other Medicare patients because of it. And I can see how immediately this might work, but if I were a doctor looking to set up a practice, I sure wouldn't go near a community that had a lot of elderly people in it. And I think this could backfire on us in that, you know, we become very careful who we accept for patients in the first place and where we locate practices. King City would not be a really great place to put a practice under this law. And on the other side of that, I think there's no doubt from numerous studies that Medicare does not pay the freight.
Why don't we hear testimony and then we'll have discussion after that? Let's finish the testimony first. Representative Kotek, does that work for you? Do you have a question?
I'd be happy to wait, but I do have a comment in support of the bill.
Okay. Yes, please go ahead.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Bob Brown, and I'm a leader in the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, also known as MACG. I'm also on the board of Oregon Health Action Campaign. And I have to say, this was when I was asked to testify for this in favor of this bill, it was a welcome relief compared to all the things that I've been doing with House Bill 2009, which is much, much more complicated. What I really wanted to do is tell you a story. And it's a story. I sent out an email to our various people, and I got a number of responses back about people that have had this exact same thing happen to them. And the story is from a person named Stan who has a wife and recently became eligible for Medicare. And he was told, see you around, basically. And he really didn't know what to do. His wife and he were both served by the same physician. He really felt like he had no recourse. He felt like, where is the loyalty in physicians treating me? You know, I have a relationship with this doctor. And he just really had no recourse. And, there were a number of very similar kind of stories that I've heard from other people. There's probably not a lot of physical data on this, but I think it probably happens more than we know about. My email out to about 15 people, got two responses back. So, that's not statistically relevant, but it was very striking to me. I hadn't even thought about this. This issue until I was asked to testify. So I am here in support of this bill, and I would hope that you would pass it through. And I understand all the comments that Representative Maurer and Representative Thompson were making. It was the same questions I had with Logan when I was talking to him about this bill. But all in all, I think it's a moral stance that I think that we need to take. What's the right thing to do? I think that we should take a stand on this. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. We have Nicole Armstrong, Jim Davis. Dr. Smith, you might join us in this panel as well, if you would.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment a little bit on this issue. Certainly, as the previous person had testified, we kind of sent this up the flagpole last night to see what kind of response we get back, particularly from the SHEBA program, the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Program that's administered in the area agencies. And we had several responses from all over the state. We had one person sharing with us that there were a number of individuals attending a Medicare 101 in Bend and Redmond and told of the letter that they received from their doctor, similar to what you'd heard before, that said, thank you so much for being our patient for the last 25 years. When you start Medicare, I'm sorry, we'll no longer be able to see you. And that is something that we've heard over and over again in the last 24 hours from every which place you could think of in the state, particularly in the rural areas. It's very difficult for individual seniors to find those kind of providers. Doing a little research, in 2004, 11.8% of primary care physicians did not accept new Medicare patients, and in 2006, that had doubled to 23%. So certainly, it is an issue of being able to access the kinds of services you need to be able to stay healthy as you continue on in life. It is a struggle for a number of individuals. It is something that we see and hear about more and more often and through the SHEBA program, through our case managers, through individuals, just trying to find some way to replace the care that they've had previously and to be able to maintain that consistency of the relationship that you build with the physician, which is terribly important in your ongoing health care. So we thank you for the conversation about this issue, and we support finding some sort of a solution to help these individuals that are trying to find a way to continue to stay as healthy as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. David?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, and the Oregon Consumer League. And we are very pleased that HB 3243 is addressing the very critical issue, a very critical issue for Oregon seniors, namely finding a primary care doctor who accepts Medicare. We appreciate Representative Denbrough's efforts on this and other senior issues this session. Many of our elders are watching as a growing number of their doctors are no longer accepting Medicare, and they're beginning to see that their options are dwindling greatly. And that's a heck of a good example there in terms of someone being with a doctor for 25 years and being dropped. I think that's unconscionable and should never happen. This has always been a real sore point with me and other of our advocates. It is simply not fair for a practitioner to drop longtime patients who must then scramble to provide other to find other providers. They have a right to choose new patients. We'd love to see them take on more of a burden of the Medicare load because we're going to all need to care for our elders. But I most certainly believe that they should take responsibility for long-time patient relationships and not drop patients. I mean, I just don't, it's just not right. This shortage of Medicare physicians is becoming a very major problem in our senior population, which is going to come close to doubling in this state over the next 20, 25 years. And so if it's such a great problem now, what happens in 10, 20 years and with a very large boomer population coming into the mix? But this issue does have a very sharp double-edged sword to it, and Representative Maurer, I think, brought some of those issues out. And this is something we've fought for as senior advocates as well, around the whole issue of Medicare justice and Oregon having some of the lowest reimbursement rates in the country. This is something that needs to be addressed in Medicare reform by Congress and is a very important issue to us. So you can't totally blame physicians for their concerns around reimbursements and paying their bills and things like that, particularly outside Medicare Advantage. But I still say they have responsibility. We must all take responsibility for our elders. And I think this is what this bill is about, is taking responsibility for these individuals who will not have a lot of other options. So I appreciate the efforts of this committee and the legislature to finally grapple with this tremendous shortage of Medicare physicians. And I think we're going to really have to start planning for the future. We need to start setting up mechanisms to plan for what's going to happen when the boomer population comes in. And this is just a tip of the iceberg of the issues we need to deal with around the boomer population. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Dr. Smith?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research. Representative Denbrough's office asked to see what kind of information we had about this concern, and as mentioned before, the Oregon Health Fund Board did come up quite a bit, some discussion, and their Federal Laws Committee had actual testimony from Medicare beneficiaries. So what I put together is sort of a summary, and I won't go into massive detail on each of the slides, but just kind of give you a snapshot, and apologies to Representative Kotek. Some of them are from the talk she made me do the other day at Ways and Means. But
I'm smiling because you always seem to come up with data. I'm like, wow, she can whip up her presentation on anything. Like, way to go, Thomas.
She has an automatic random table generator.
Totally.
I actually have also great staff. But, the first page just shows you what I could find on a national level, which gives you the picture on the big scale. It's from the Commonwealth Fund. It's a little bit old, 2005. But comparing commercial insurance versus Medicare. Let me see if I can give you guys, since you're here, some copies. But on a nationwide basis, there isn't quite that much difference between commercially insured and Medicare, but you also have to think about this as aggregate, and there are other parts of the country that get much better reimbursement. For example, in 2006, Medicare spent an average of $6,451 per Medicare enrollee in Oregon, compared to a national average of almost $8,000 per enrollee. Florida's average cost in Medicare, they pay out over $9,462. $2. So if you're seeing a Medicare patient in Florida as a primary care physician, you're seeing, you know, a considerably more dollars per visit than you are if you're seeing that same patient here in Oregon. I mean, a $3,000 more per enrollee per year in Florida than us. The next slide just gives you a breakdown of how many folks, based on our last population survey that Medicare covers. It's a little over almost 550,000 folks as of that survey. We think some of the newer data is probably showing it's a little higher, about 570,000, or about 15% of the state population. And about 40% of Oregon's current Medicare beneficiaries are covered by Medicare Advantage plans. These are the privately run PPOs and HMOs style plans, and that's actually the highest proportion in the nation is on Medicare Advantage is here in Oregon. The next slide reinforces.
Sorry, Dr. Smith, when you say Medicare Advantage, are they Medicare managed fee for service or Medicare managed?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, they're HMO. Managed care or PPO type network plans predominantly in Medicare Advantage. There was a lot of discussion about some of the problems on a nationwide basis with Medicare Advantage are in some of the plans that in a different style, more the Medicare fee-for-service type plans, and in talking to Region 10 CMS officials, they're actually pretty have much less complaints, if hardly any, about our type of the majority of our Medicare Advantage plans here in the state. So there is a lot national, like there's a lot of problems, and the Obama administration is looking at possibly lowering the Medicare Advantage rates, but actually that could be a disadvantage for Oregon. I actually had a conversation with some of our congressional delegation about this and how this may actually harm Oregon, because those are the better rates that more of the physicians are choosing to see Medicare eligibles through a Medicare Advantage plan than they are through just traditional fee-for-service. But the ones that are more controversial are some of these more
Pyramid, Vantra, WellPoint, yes. The local ones, in-state ones.
A lot of them are built on our current managed care community plans, and so they are used to working with the community, used to managing the care, and now they've just added a Medicare line to what they're already handling, a lot of the Medicaid patients in that community already. And so for the dual eligibles, it's the same management.
Okay.
So the slide just shows you the Medicare enrollment has grown and is growing. And the next one gives you some estimates about how it is increasing rapidly, which are points that were already made. With some newer national estimates, newer even than this slide, that Oregonians covered by Medicare is expected to increase by 67% by 2020. And the next slide is a national picture of how practice costs, inflation, and Medicare payments are not keeping pace with each other. And the practice cost inflation is rising higher than what they're actually getting paid through Medicare. And again, this is a national picture. I don't have anything for Oregon. But again, because Oregon's Medicare rate is lower than many of our East Coast states, it's due to our historically lower utilization and increased efficiency. Back when I was in full-time practice, you know, we were just so efficient in our managed care that has actually worked against us over time. And if you had a bonus payments for being efficient, maybe Oregon would get them, but they don't
have. In the fee-for-service side as well?
The Medicare Advantage
physician paid different for a same relative RVU than other physicians are in other states? Or is it the Medicaid?
No, I mean,
it's not the capitation that's low.
It's the base rate is lower for Oregon than it is for, say, Florida. That's why there's that difference in fee-for-service, traditional fee-for-service.
And if you work in rural Oregon, it's lower than if you work in
because
Oregon.
Of the county difference.
The cost of care of the community is factored into the development of the RVS calculation.
Right, but there's only Portland and other.
Correct. In the East Coast, they don't know the rest of the state geography very well.
There is, but we could pass a memorial pointing out to CMS that there is parts of Oregon outside of the Portland metropolitan area.
we could add that
to the same memorial that we're
We could solve the problem by saying, let's just be like Maryland.
Pass the memorial. Okay.
The slide that says Oregon leads the country in Medicare Advantage enrollment, I already mentioned that, and that just sort of shows you. But as we heard in the Federal Laws Committee, many of the beneficiaries testifying to the committee said that, you know, that enrolling in a Medicare Advantage plan was the only way they were able to find a physician to treat them, since it is the higher, more preferred reimbursement. So then we have an Oregon Physician Workforce Survey. We did it in 2004, 2006, and the 2008 is still being finalized and collected, so I didn't have any new data. But we've partnered with the Oregon Medical Association and the Division of Medical Assistance to do this survey every 2 years. We ask about how well they're accepting payments from all kinds of payers, Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial, and were their practices closed. And so the first slide is their acceptance by Medicare by specialty in 2006. And you can see statewide, 66% of all physicians reported that their practice had no limitations for new Medicare. However, this differed by specialty. Only 46% of family practice physicians and 56% of internal medicine physicians indicated they were completely open to new Medicare patients. The availability of psychiatrists was significantly constrained. Only 34% reported being open with no restrictions. And then, as mentioned before, only 21% of family physicians and 25% of general internal medicine practitioners reported being completely closed to new Medicare patients. The next one breaks it down more by regions. You can see the different parts. And actually, the rural areas are a little more likely to accept Medicare and Medicaid than some of the urban areas. And then we broke out, just compared what had been happening in the 2004 survey to the 2006 around acceptance of Medicare. And these results represent an increase in the number of practices completely closed to new Medicare patients. And I think it was mentioned 11% were closed to new in 2004, while that has increased to 17%. And then it's much more of a marked deterioration of access to primary care, as was mentioned. And that
this isn't the question whether they continue to accept existing patients.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, you know, I looked back at the survey, and we just asked, you know, are you closed or partially closed? We didn't ask, have you been dropping people lately?
Thank you.
And
what do you mean by restrict? What is the definition of restrict?
I think we just had asked if they were no limitations, restrict, and completely closed. So they're wide open, no limitations, not going to, you know, once they cap a certain number. Restrict, we didn't define restrict as anything specific. We just asked, do you restrict, and then are you completely closed? So we just had those three choices. So the primary care acceptance of new Medicare patients, this has almost doubled. The percent that were closed to new patients has doubled from 13% to almost to 22%, and as has the number decreased on those who report no restrictions. And again, you need to consider that this group, the primary care physicians, are the ones with lower overall reimbursement. And then we asked why they were closing, for those who had reported either closing or limiting their practices. And we asked a series of reasons. And by far the most important factor identified was reimbursement level, followed by the need to balance payer mix and administrative requirements. And if you think about it, if you have very low payment on Medicare, you have low payment on Medicaid, then you have to make up everything else through commercial. And so it is a balance of payer mix, like any business, to try to balance that. And so if you were in Florida, actually Medicare pays better than commercial in Florida. It would be actually something advantageous to have come in the door.
You have to live in Florida.
But yeah, there would be, you know, termites or something. But, and so then the last is, I did put in, just for comparison, the acceptance of new Medicaid patients compared in 2004 and 2006.
So I think if providers are essentially forced to accommodate Medicare patients despite the low reimbursement, they could react in several ways. While some providers could absorb the reduced income associated with a higher proportion of Medicare, others would seek to increase revenue from other sources, reduce overhead of staffing, or even terminate relationships with patients prior to the deadline established in the bill. Some providers could continue to terminate relationships with patients who become eligible for Medicare and devise a different reason for terminating their relationship. Some providers, however, could make a strong case that their financial viability could be threatened by retaining patients who become eligible for Medicare. So the last slide just summarizes what the Health Fund Board and its Federal Laws Committee recommended. Basically, the major emphasis was, as mentioned before, getting equitable Medicare reimbursement and some targeted payment reform around primary care and better care coordination. The other short-term solution was how could we expand Medicare Advantage plans in all areas of the state and also work with the federal delegation to make sure that we aren't disadvantaged if there are changes in the Medicare Advantage plans on a national level. But they certainly recognize that this was a significant issue, realizing that it's the root cause you need to get to really change it, and that is the reimbursement issue.
Well, I think it's very useful data, Dr. Smith. Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, we have a couple more witnesses. Thank you very much. Ruth McEwens. McEwen's still with us? Oh, here we go.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Ruth McEwen. I'm from Salem. And I don't have a written testimony because I didn't know until 5 minutes before three that I was going to get to testify. So I'm just going to wing it with you. The reason I was asked to come is because I have been going through the situation of receiving a letter in the mail from my doctor saying that she was no longer going to be in practice and not knowing that it was coming or anything. And then I went to her and got some prescriptions ahead of time so that I wouldn't always, just run out because I knew about the problems of finding a new doctor. And I hunted and hunted, and I still hadn't found one 6 months later that would accept me. And then finally my insurance company started shaking the bushes to see what they could find, and it took them almost a month to try to find someone. And what the best part about it was, it was 3 months out for me to get an appointment with that doctor. About 7 weeks into waiting, I got a letter from that doctor saying that he had quit his practice. And so I went through the system again of trying to find another doctor that would take me because I'm on Medicare. And finally found somebody that would finally take me. But at that time, if my other doctor, the first doctor, had not given me this prescription ahead of time, I would have been out without medications. And so there is a real need out there to find and to work with doctors for Medicaid and Medicare services because they're just pulling out because of the low reimbursement rate. And then another thing that I'm concerned about in this bill and what I've heard here in this discussion is that this is not only just for seniors. There are many people with disabilities that are on Social Security disability, and they are on Medicare, too, and they are facing the same thing, and I am one of those people. And so we need to remember that there is not just an age thing. It is a population, and all the population that are on Medicare are affected by this.
Ms. McEwen, did you need medical care in between while you were trying to get
organized? I did. Yes, I did.
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. I have systemic lupus, and that makes me sometimes have some real bad times. Mm-hmm. But I did not have any medical coverage or any medical care at that time.
Any questions? Thank you for testifying. We have Dr. Peter Bernardo and John Mullen would like to testify. And that's
going to be the most incongruous testimony you'll have today.
Thank you for coming down. I appreciate it. Let's let Mr. Mullen start, and then you can have the final go at it, Dr. Bernardo.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm glad that you're having this discussion. I want to point out that there's been discussion about the Oregon Health Fund Board and the Federal Laws Committee that had discussion. I served on the Eligibility and Enrollment Committee, and we had significant discussion about Medicare issues. There are a number of things that pertain to Medicare, which House Bill 3243 is trying to address one of them, and that is the lack of coverage and physicians not taking people on Medicare. But I just also wanted to briefly mention that people on Medicare are also chronically underinsured. People on Medicare pay more out of pocket than before the beginning of Medicare. People are paying significant amounts of the costs themselves. And then we also had discussion about the people who are, like Ruth McEwen just testified, that have a disability, that are on SSDI, that have a two-year waiting period to get on Medicare. So I just wanted to simply point out that all of the good work that you're all doing on such things as House Bill 2009 are addressing very important issues, but we have a population, the Medicare population, that has a number of significant problems, and I'm very pleased you're discussing them today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Peter Bernardo. I'm a surgeon here in Salem. I'm attending a benefit. and I'm supposed to have my picture taken with Sarah Ferguson here in about a half hour, so I came dressed so I could go straight there, but that's not necessarily my day-to-day garb. I'm president-elect of the Oregon Medical Association. I'm a solo practice general surgeon, and I have been here in Salem for 17 years now. I come to speak against this House bill. I understand the sentiment behind requiring physicians to not drop their patients as they transition to Medicare, but I really think this is the wrong approach. It's punitive, and it will not help our situation. I have some handouts for you that discuss just how difficult it is to be a physician in this state. Like I said, my clothes notwithstanding, this is a tough environment to be a physician. And as we talk about health care issues, as we talk about access to care, the fact is in this state we don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough doctors to provide care on a daily basis to patients, no matter what their insurance status is, whether they're uninsured, underinsured, as with Medicaid and Medicare, or TRICARE, our government military services program, or insured by what we would sometimes refer to as good insurance, commercial insurance. We need more doctors at every level of health care, whether it's specialists, but in particular in primary care. We need more physicians in the rural areas. I would speak for my primary care colleagues because they're really the ones who are facing the difficult economies and the ones who are making their decisions about turning away long-term patients. The vast majority of specialist offices don't see patients on a recurrent basis necessarily. They are open to patients, but they're not responsible for the day-to-day care. And most specialist offices continue to see patients regardless of their insurance status. It's the primary care office that has to manage that patient day-to-day and has to try to cover their overhead with the reimbursement that comes from Medicare and Medicaid. Some of our handouts will discuss just what those reimbursements are like. I think it's important to point out that under Medicare, the reimbursement program for physicians is separate from hospitals. Hospital reimbursements have gone up consistently and in keeping with medical inflation over the last 10 years. Physician reimbursements essentially have remained unchanged in the last 10 years. That means we have not even kept up with
consumer price index rate of inflation. So we've lost money. Same is true for the Oregon Health Plan. We haven't seen a raise from Oregon Health Plan in the last 10 years. I think to our credit, the majority of physicians in this community and this state continue to see those patients in spite of what is grossly under reimbursement. There's a tremendous cost shift associated with that, and we can argue about how much commercial plans are paying in compensation for the lack of reimbursement that comes from the federal programs. But the fact is, if you live in rural Oregon in this state, you're seeing Medicare and Medicaid patients and a few commercial patients. And it's very difficult to keep your office open with just Medicare and Medicaid patients. To our knowledge, the number of physicians who are turning away patients as they approach Medicare is not great, but it's not quantitative, and I don't have numbers for you. The numbers on offices that are not accepting new patients are very real. And I sympathize with the last patient. We see those folks every day in my office as a specialist. New patients to this community, healthy, elderly folks with Medicare insurance who come to my office for a surgical problem, and they can't find a primary care doctor. And we can call, and I call, but the offices are full. There isn't a primary care office in town that doesn't have a full roster of patients. Against that backdrop, they're very likely to say, we'd like to get another commercial patient because it's going to offset the uninsured work we do. Marion Polk County, 17.5% of our patients uninsured. OHP, a big part of our practice. I mean, when you compare all those groups, Medicare, TRICARE, Medicaid, and uninsured, that's 55% of what we see on a daily basis in this area. It's tough to keep your office open. This approach, as I said, I sympathize, but this is not the way to approach this problem. And in fact, it would further exacerbate our situation. This is already a tough state to recruit physicians to. I've already outlined the economics of it. As you know, we have a little bit of a problem with our medical liability insurance.
We've heard.
And that adds to the difficulty in recruiting physicians to the state. We certainly don't graduate and train enough physicians to meet our needs. And so we're in competition with every other state in the union to attract the small population of trained physicians every year that are graduating. And this is not something that will engender a lot of interest in coming to our state to practice medicine.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Dr. Bernardo, and nice talks. I have a question about the page that shows the costs per unit or the charges and payments per unit of care. And I think we all sympathize. We're all very aware of the challenges that you face on Medicare and OHP reimbursement. I'm just trying to make sense of this. So the physician charges, the actual sort of cost that you call true cost of providing services, is $120 to $140 per unit.
I wouldn't call that necessarily true cost. In my office, we refer that as it's the unicorn. It's a mythical number. That's the usual and customary fee that we used to charge and that has risen with CPI, not with medical inflation, over time. We use that number to compare apples to apples over the years. So,
not quite true cost. Okay, I'm reading from what you provided.
I understand.
The amount reflects the true cost of providing healthcare services. So, I'm a little confused.
Right.
I guess given that all the reimbursements, including commercial insurers, fall at less than half or barely half at the best of physician charges. It's hard to make sense of that. It would appear that no physician is able to recover.
Right, and I apologize for that. The numbers on there below physician charges, all those other unit conversion factors, are real numbers. The physician charge is a usual and customary number. That's not. What's the cost of doing business? That usual and customary charge, that's the amount that I'd love to get paid for an individual work, and then I wouldn't have to work quite so hard to see all those patients, and I can still pay my overhead.
Do you have a sense of where the actual cost number falls? I assume, based on what the kinds of conversations we've had, that it's actually below the $60 to $75 per unit that the commercial payers pay. My understanding is that commercial payers are, in part, subsidizing this cost shift. So that true cost falls probably somewhere less than $65, but greater than the 36 at Medicare, and this is a very complex subject.
Right. And this is a tough discussion. I can tell you that the commercial discounted rate that we are forced to accept from the carriers is a number that I think is closer to what true cost is. When you look at the Oregon Health Fund Board work and you discuss what the cost shift is, and I know many of you have looked at those numbers, and you look at certainly on the hospital side and the overall cost of medicine, where the true line of health care cost is, commercial rates are 20% higher than that true cost, perhaps, and then all the government programs are some line below that, and if you average it, you get a middle number. I will tell you that if that middle number on average is somewhere around $55 for my practice, that doesn't meet my cost. The commercial rate that we accept is a number that is that we can live with. It's a number that reflects whatever bargaining power we have with the insurers, and we don't have a lot of bargaining power with them. We have no bargaining power with the government, so that we take whatever they give us, and we suffer as a result.
Thank you.
I think that it is. I looked at this patient. I said, "Uh-oh, that doesn't make sense," because as it's written, you never make money. You always lose money.
Right.
But the reality is, at the end of the year, you're, as a surgeon, you are not on food stamps, and you're able to pay your own personal bills, and which is completely acceptable, and because we want good and smart people to be doing these jobs. But the way I see it is, you get marginal increases through your commercial payers, not full medical inflation increase. The government payer, kind of for surgeon, I think has dropped, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has.
Yeah. It has not increased. In fact, in real dollars, it's dropped, which
right.
is a huge problem. So what you do is you work harder. And,
yes.
And what I've seen or from the surgeons, from the people that cut that I see is, in fact, their workload, that's where they make their money, is they see 2% or 3% more patients year over year. And so what they do is they start adding a CNA here, and they try to do a little bit here. I mean, it's the business model changes to try to keep your salary. I'm assuming you're an independent provider.
Yes.
Because you absorb the gains or losses.
And that's the difference between the surgeon's office and the primary care office. The primary care office has a high fixed overhead and a limited number of hours in the day that their physicians can see patients. And they're already full. They don't have the ability to increase their volume to make more money. A surgeon, at a certain point, will be full. But if you're fast and efficient and you're willing to see more patients and work more hours, your overhead is fixed, and you can even an undercompensated patient brings in money. And so it's a different model for a surgeon's office. There's no doubt I make money, and that margin in the end, I'm a solo practice surgeon. The money that comes to me pays my taxes, pays my overhead, and what's left is my salary. And in the end, you argue about what you think my salary should be. But, we do all right. We make money because we see patients, and hopefully we're good and efficient at doing it.
Representative Kotick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming in, Dr. Bernardo. I know you have a place to be. But I was wondering, has the Oregon Medical Association discussed the aspect of the bill, doctors terminating folks when they reach Medicare eligibility age? Have they talked about this problem? Cost of Medicare reimbursements aside,
right.
This particular issue.
First, I want to say that physicians terminate patients not infrequently, for any number of reasons. And that they have that right, 30-day notice, they don't have to give cause. And this is an issue that happens not infrequently in practices. It happens because of personality problems. It happens because of patients who abuse the system, any number of reasons. And so this is an issue that every physician and every specialty faces all the time. There's, I will tell you that the majority of physicians who are sick about the idea that you're going to have to turn somebody away, or you're going to cut someone out of your practice because of their insurance status. But, I mean, it goes against and rubs raw against all those things that we hold dear as physicians, as professionals. But I will also defend the right of my primary care physicians to do what they need to do to stay in business, because in the end, if they can't meet their bottom line, then they close their practice. And here you've heard a patient today who ran through two primary care doctors in a year for whatever reason. It's a difficult practice environment. And if you can't pay your bills, then you're not seeing anybody. And to my mind, that's the bigger problem.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yeah, and there was a comment on it in your testimony.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. The association has passed a resolution that discourages physicians from removing Medicare patients from their services solely due to payment concerns.
Yes.
What was that conversation like?
It was a difficult.
And why did they pass a resolution?
It was a difficult conversation. It happened at the House of Delegates in the last couple of years, and it was just this issue. I mean, this is an issue that's been on the news. We've all know about it. And passed that resolution. In part, we passed that resolution after some discussion with Chair Greenlich and other members of this body. It was not an easy discussion. And I recognize that we are a diverse group of individuals. This is not an issue that affects the majority of physicians. It's very easy for me to point at a primary care office and say, you need to take these patients, you need to keep these patients. They have a different practice model and a slightly different manner of staying open than I do. But in the end, though we can discourage them, to say that it's wrong, to say it's ethically wrong, to say they shouldn't do it, to my mind, is not reasonable. It's hard. It's a hard discussion, but unfortunately, the business of medicine is a part of the practice and profession of medicine, and they go hand in hand. If you can't pay your bills and you can't keep your doors open, you're not doing your patients any good.
Thank you, Doctor.
Is that resolution now a part of the policy of the association?
It is.
You make that resolution available
yes.
for us?
Yes. Our staff provide it for you.
Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We've heard a lot of testimony about the difficulties of keeping the doors open and about attracting physicians here. Now, this would be another obstacle to attracting. Do we have any data on folks having closed up shop here and moved away? I say folks, I mean practitioners.
When I came to Salem in 1992, there were 17 general surgeons in active practice in the Mid-Valley. 17 years later, there are 16 general surgeons in active practice in Salem. We have a 30% increase in our population in that time. I can be happy to run down the local network of specialists. We have made some gains, but not in keeping with our population growth, and recognize that we were underserved in 1992 when I came to town.
And the population in general is aging.
Yes, they're not getting healthier.
No, and the practitioner population is aging as well.
Yes.
So we've lost some that way and are about to lose some more that way.
Yes.
I'm really wondering if we have folks leaving the state.
Mr. Chair, one other. I'm assuming that most of these providers are independent practitioners or small business owners that are doing this. If Kaiser instituted this policy, I think then the conversation is much different because of the system doing it.
And they've done the opposite. They've
okay.
enrolled
but if it's an individual provider, these people, they're not doing it because they're because they're primary care providers for the most part. They're doing it. There's a reason. It's not doing. They're not saying, "Oh, I'm making, I'm you know, going to stay in business another 20 years, and I'm making too much money. So let's play with the numbers here or make enough." I mean, these are small business owners. I guess you're really putting them against between a rock and a hard place.
Well, I would say that Kaiser made that decision a few years ago for the Oregon Health Plan, that they made that business decision for several years to not take Oregon Health Plan patients, and those were patients that went in and out of their system and then back on now. But, you know, those business decisions get made at a lot of different levels. And the individual, the majority of, I believe, I mean, there's no data on who's dropping patients. It's not data that's very easy to acquire. The ones that have been prominent in the news have classically been small offices, one, twos, threes, doctors, individual practitioners, because that's where the margin is the tightest.
Can I ask a sort of general philosophical question? It's been a while since I've studied medical ethics, but it was something that I studied. Isn't there a concept called patient abandonment?
Yes.
And what does that mean? What's?
I'm not sure I can describe that very well for you. So when we look at patients and their ability to find physicians, you know, trying to give them enough notice so that they can find a new physician in their area or somewhere, we do our best to do that. I have patients who clearly I should not see, that have been to my office, have been personally threatening to my office and staff, and they have been cut from my practice. And they'll get a nice letter from me, and they'll refer them back to their primary care doctor or to somewhere else to get care. It's something that you have to do and from time to time.
But I do seem to remember that there is a concept called patient abandonment, which is viewed as an ethical practice, and I was just trying to figure out where the boundaries of that question of abandonment are. I mean, for example, you have heinous... This has been added to a section on unprofessional treatment that has such heinous things as employing any person to solicit patients for the licensee. Now, does that sound worse to you than abandoning a patient of long standing? I mean, that's out of the statute. That's not something I just made up.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's design. That's defined by the...
Mr. Chairman, I guess, you know, I'm having a hard time with the pressure on this issue. I think more specifically, it's, is it appropriate social policy to ask people to see people for less than they are reimbursed for it? And that's...
You're not doing it for less than they're reimbursed. You're asking.
Well, I mean, excuse me, I misstated that. But I mean, you know, I saw this all the time. When I used to work, I worked a lot with the issue of divorce. And very commonly, in the midst of divorce, particularly back in the 70s and 80s, typically the women were abandoned and there was very little support in that adversarial system. And I saw a lot of those people for nothing or very modest amounts according to what they could afford or insurance only. And parts of that is a decency, a responsibility to client. But there also comes a point at which you can't afford to do this. And, you know, I've been reading on this topic because it's interesting. For example, in some of the retirement areas up here in the mountains and in Bend, they're having a very difficult time because the population of us baby boomers is getting so blooming big. Their Medicare reimbursement, it's impossible in Sisters to find a physician that will take a Medicare patient, according to an article I read about 3 months ago. And the fact... I think to ask those doctors to see those people for less than it costs them to see them, for a few, that's probably an ethical responsibility. But at some level, that's ridiculous. We don't ask the stores to sell their food for less than it costs.
If you were in the middle of a course of therapy with one of your patients, and their insurance status changed, would you abandon them?
You know, it's really, you see, you use, would I abandon them? Is it abandoning them, or is it not another reality?
Would you stop seeing them?
I've done it both ways. And I've seen them for as little as nothing, for extended periods of time. I've helped them find other sources. I've referred them to other people. It depends on the circumstance, and frankly, it also depended on my financial circumstance. I would guess that I forgave about 30% of the fees that I charged.
Yes.
And I made comparatively a modest amount because that was a personal values dedication about the way I did it. And incidentally, I received considerable criticism for undercutting some of the professional charges that some of my peers made. But the issue here is, you know, we make those decisions. How are we, you know, are you going to ask people to sell their skills for less than they're worth? And less than they can even objectively demonstrate it cost them. And in the primary physician, these people literally, their overhead costs are astronomical. And to pay them $36 a unit, it doesn't cover their cost. Why should we as a social policy ask an individual to do that? Now, you know, the question was a good one about, well, maybe in larger organizations and part of HMOs and other things, is hopefully you have a balance. And frankly, that's what I used to find. You know, I had some patients who were in good shape, and they paid very substantially for my services. And that was cross-subsidized, but by me. And I'm the one who received less. I think we need to be careful when we start calling that abandonment, because, you know, it's also abandonment for me not to charge a fair price and not have the funds to adequately support my family.
Sure.
And I think that's the balance. That's a very ticklish one.
I think Dr. Bernardo's made a point, and the point is that once you have a fixed overhead, you cover that overhead by getting different amounts of reimbursement from different places, just
yep.
like a grocery store does. You wouldn't expect a grocery store to make the same profit. I mean,
they have lost leaders,
and they have, depends on how they have to buy it, and if they can't buy it cheap enough, then they sell it more, or they don't sell it. I mean, even in a pure commercial trade. But the issue here is one of professional responsibility.
Yep.
And we're not here to define morals. I think that's really clear. But when you have a statute that allows the medical board to censure a physician because they're employing any person to solicit patients and a variety of other things, then the question is it proper social policy to add issues of, well, I have trouble not using abandonment.
Well,
somebody has a long relationship with a physician, and then the physician refuses to see him simply because of a financial situation. I think we have a legitimate cause to ask, is that how we serve functions? Representative Kotek and then Representative Thompson, and it's at 5 o'clock.
It is 5, and I know... you need to be somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is a complex issue, and I agree with Dr. Bernardo and my colleagues of the complexity of this, but I agree with the Chair. This is a very, after the amendments, a very elegantly written bill, situating within the code of conduct for physicians as dictated by the medical board. And I think, if anything, this discussion down the lane of Medicare costs and reimbursements has actually increased the reality in all of our minds that when you say to someone, I've been your physician for so many years and now I'm going to terminate you because you are Medicare eligible, there is very little place for that person to go. So it is even magnified in our current setting. And this isn't about new patients. This isn't about managing your payer mix. I think it's certainly unfortunate but realistic that a provider is going to manage new folks into their system. But this is about continuity of care. This is about quality of care. This is about ethical conduct. And I think it's totally appropriate to be doing this. And the fact that even your association had this conduct because you're uncomfortable with it there are folks who are uncomfortable that other physicians are doing this. I think this is totally appropriate. And I disagree with those folks who think it isn't.
You get the last word, or I'll give Dr. Bernardo the last word, actually. So you get the penultimate word.
You brought up abandonment, not me. But I see this a little differently on who's doing the abandoning. What would happen if we took all of our Oregon Trail Card participants in Oregon And we took the cards back and told them, instead, you go to the grocery store, and the grocery stores are going to sell you whatever you want at below wholesale. That saves us a lot of money to do that.
I'd say we were ending them.
Okay, that's my point. So we're saying that the federal government is funding Medicare at a ridiculously low rate, especially for Oregon. That seems we all agree on that. But that professionally, medical practitioners should accept that fee. If you carry that over, then if a person loses their job here in Salem and loses their Blue Cross insurance, then the medical community should also continue to treat those patients at no revenue, because otherwise it would be abandonment.
Yeah, I would say that, in fact. If they had a long-term relationship, I think that's in the history of
medicine. I think
we're
guaranteeing the closure of a whole lot of medical facilities in taking that approach. I would rather
suggest... I can't tell you, you cannot give me a working physician in this community that qualifies for Medicaid. There are not working physicians who are starving, who have an Oregon Trail card because they can't make a living.
I might accept that challenge, Mr. Chair.
Well,
I think we have some very close in our rural communities, but you know, I would rather
we need to do something about that. We all agree to that.
I would rather see the emphasis of this committee be on putting together a contingent to go back to Washington and take this thing on head on. We've been dealing with this for years now. Why do we accept this?
Because I remember what happened before Medicare. Before Medicare, people retired at age 65. I was here, and I was involved in getting Medicare. They retired at age 65 and lost their health insurance, and then they had no money. And what we've done, and they would still be those doctors' patients, what we've done with Medicare, whether we like it or not, is we've provided a social insurance program that provides reimbursement. And it's up to us and our tax dollars how much we want to pay for that. But the fact is, seniors are better off today than they were in 1964. And doctors are better off today than they were in 1964.
I think it's obscuring the real problem. I mean, if Dr. Bernardo had not been here for so long, I could get him a job in Texas tomorrow. But his dedication to the community keeps him here.
You also have to live in Texas.
That's also true, yes. But,
which is even worse than Florida.
We are putting ourselves at increasing disadvantage medically in Oregon at the time we're trying to look at a way out of the healthcare crisis. And, you know, we're at the bottom of the hole right now. And for God's sake, let's not take out the shovel and start digging. You know, we need to go the other way. And this, I don't think this is going to do that.
Well, we're trying to do that, for example, with House Bill 2009, to try and take people that are zero payers now and turn them into less than cost payers, but at Medicare rates, which is very much greater than not having anything. And that, I think we are trying to do something.
But will it be acceptable when we get an increasingly aging population?
Well, it'll be more acceptable than having a million uninsured instead of 600,000, because those million uninsured will show up in the emergency rooms where they have to be taken care of, and they'll show up in the hospital where they have to be taken care of, and there'll be $0 to pay for it. And that's not going to help the physicians of our community.
And there are fewer emergency rooms today than there were.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for breaking our string of boring Friday afternoons.
Dr. Bernardo, thank you so much for coming. We really do. We really do appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And good luck.
We close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.